First session of the day. Meeting is being recorded. All right, so welcome to Philly.net Code Camp 2010.1, the first Code Camp for this year. Here is our partners, our platinum and gold partners that are basically making today possible through their donations and prizes and everything that we'll be recording at the end of the day. And just so you know, we are being recorded. This session is being recorded. It will be available via Channel 9 at some point. I don't really have much more details than that, but we are being recorded. Because of that, I'm going to kind of try and I'm going to ask you if you have questions at various intervals, but we're going to try and kind of keep the questions to the end. So we're watching the webcast. We don't have to kind of questions that are happening. And so this session is what's new and hot in .NET 4.0. So this is not going to be a kind of deep dive into anything. This is kind of covering all of the very interesting new and updated stuff. Mention, let alone go in. Actually, not even going to be able to everything. Mention. So here are the boring credentials. Who am I? My name is Jess Chadwick. I'm an independent consultant. Oh, let me go back real quick. My blog over here, blog.jesschadwick.com. There's slide decks and everything for this show. You can also follow me on Twitter, jchadwick. A little information about me, boring credentials. I've got a decade of development experience, recently turned independent consultant, speaker, user group leader, Microsoft MVP at ASP.NET, ASP Insider, writer. All of that. All right. So, what is the .NET framework? Here we have an image of kind of breaking all of the framework as a whole into kind of different sections. So starting at the bottom, we have the CLR, the Common Language Runtime. Stuff that makes everything work, that everything else is built on top of that. So on top of that, we've got our base class libraries, or BCLs, referring to it throughout the presentation. This is generally system dot whatever, or base library. Then on top of that, we have what I'm referring to as platforms in this talk. So we actually have things like WPF, WinForms, things that are built on the base class libraries that enable you to step service, do what you gotta do. So here is what we're going to be kind of mentioning in this talk. This is kind of a general overview of what is new and updated in .NET 4.0. So we start with the CLR. We've got some advances to the CLR, some fixes, performance tweaks, and whatnot. Then we move on to the base class library. We've got a few classes in there. And then they have a big push on performance, concurrency, and parallelization. A lot of it help you deal with that. Languages, F#, Iron Python, etc. Language enhancements to existing languages. Let's see. Dynamic language runtime, which is very code contracts, so a way to develop your code and make assertions in your code. And Managed Extensibility Framework, or MEF. And then also we have our existing platforms, Entity Framework, WPF, Windows Workflow, ASP.NET. These have all been updated. ASP.NET MVC is now kind of officially part of the platform. Up until now, it's just been kind of out of band. They will still continue to release officially part of the framework at this point. So in the talk today, we're actually going to be focusing on, I'm going to be showing examples of just these things, and talking a little bit about this, showing examples for these things, and probably not going to get to any of the platforms. I have some slides in there that we can kind of go over real quick at the end. Unfortunately, we're not really going to move on to the .NET framework improvements. So the team, the CLR team, for this release, I concentrated on a few main goals. Working better together, faster, with fewer bugs. Under better together, we have in proc side by side. So that means you can load up assemblies from different runtimes within this. So in my .NET 4.0 process, I can actually load up 1.1. And it's extensibility framework. I'm not going to really say what that is now. I'm going to go later. The DLR, dynamic language run. And also native and managed interop. Those of you who have been doing COM development, whole process and writing COM applications interactive. Say about that at this point. Talk because I haven't, I've had the benefit of not really having to work with COM very much. Can't really give that part of the talk. So faster, so a big emphasis on threading, parallel extensions, garbage collections, so the garbage collector has been tweaked for better performance. You also have the server mode and the client mode. So in the server mode, you can then you also have some profiling enhancements. So for the profile enhancements and things like debugging, you actually have on both sides with the framework, the core framework includes enhancements, as well as the tooling, Visual Studio 10, also includes drastically better debugging and profiling tools. So under fewer bugs, we have corrupted state exceptions, code contracts, and debugging, better debugging. Moving on to the base class library additions, the BCL edition. These are some of the cool classes that have been added to the base. First off, we have the big integer, which is exactly as it sounds. It's in 32, only big. So within 32, I'm sure you know, you have the min value, max value. You can't go above those. If you want to, couldn't, now you can. It has no boundaries, it has no min. Because of that, you can run into things. So we have the big integer class, so I think it's a structure, it's a struct, that allows you to do this, and it also has methods related. We also have a couple new data structures. Tuples. So how many of you have actually used tuples in other languages? Apparently not a new concept by any means. It's been around a while in other languages. Finally do have it. Basically what a tuple is here's an example of how you would use it in code. I like to think of it as kind of a dynamic struct. So until now we've had anonymous types that you could kind of objects on the fly and assign the properties and everything on the fly. The problem with that is you couldn't actually like return it. Know about it until runtime. So with these tuples, you can actually say, I want a class that has a property of an int, a property of an int, the property of a string, and assigning my int string values. And so I can actually pass that back. Then we have sets. We have an interface, iSet of T. Set is basically a collection of items that are unique. Uniqueness is a problem in and of itself. Whatever that means, you cannot add multiple. And under the implementations, we have sorted set and hash set. Lastly, we have the memory mapped file. So those of you who have done file processing, worked with large files to load the whole thing, with memory mapped files, you can actually concentrate on one particular section of the file and not have to load and lock the entire. Those of you who have run into that, those of you who haven't, I guess you don't really. Any questions on this so far? What's that? I'm not exactly sure why they delayed. There were performance issues. That's why. Not exactly sure, actually. Yeah. Yep. What's that? Yes, I'm not exactly sure. I'm relatively certain it's not a value type, and that's the reference type, and so. Long just gives you a bigger room, gives you more bytes to use, so that you. Well, so. Right, so with a list, you can have, I can have one object, and I can just add it as many times as I want to the list and just keep on adding. Sorted set with the sets, if you try and add, and I believe it'll throw an exception, so you cannot add, it has to be unique, yeah. And then the cool thing with the sorted set is that it keeps it sorted, and they say at no performance cost. That's true. It's what they say. But yes, Mark, you had a. In the tuple, I believe it's up to 8. So I've seen things where they get around that by the 8th element is another tuple. So you can keep going. But yeah, so it is kind of strongly defined. There are classes of. We have the tuple that goes starts with 1, I guess. I don't know what it starts with, 1 or 2. But then it goes up to 8. Defined in the framework. Next up, we have performance, concurrency, parallel extensions. I'm actually going to punt on this stuff because at the end of today, in this room, this track, Joy is going to be talking about it. Just as a general overview, we have some new, more new collections, so some thread-safe collections, which are exactly the same. For example, blocking collection, concurrent dictionary, a whole handful of them. We also have the task parallel library, which, generally speaking, is a clear way to work with threading. This is, it's actually, I was listening to it on the way here, there's .NET Rocks. How many of you listen to podcasts, generally speaking? .NET Rocks, Hanselman, those kinds. A couple weeks or months back, they actually interviewed about all of the parallelization of the. Spent a good amount of time talking about the task parallel library. Carl Franklin called it the new. Going forward, you want to be using tasks. .NET Rocks, Hansel Minutes, Craig Shoemaker has a good one, Polymorphic Podcast. A lot of good ones out there. I can actually, I'll post a list of those podcasts that I listen to on my blog at justchemic.com. PLINK, Parallel Link Extensions. Cool. And then also, Lazy Initialization. So this falls under kind of the performance category. Lazy initialization or lazy loading basically means that you don't do anything. You can define a property or a variable or something, but you don't actually do anything with it. You don't load it until it's actually accessed. So if it's never accessed, it never gets loaded. Save that. So yes, I'm going to punt on basically all of this. If you want to kind of go into more detail, if you're strong into, if you use a lot of threading and concurrency, you definitely want to check out Joy's presentation. He'll also show the Visual Studio in profiling and working with threading, debugging threading. I will show an example of lazy initials. There's Joy's session, .NET 4 parallel extensions. Good afternoon. Any questions on that? I just kind of did a whirlwind. I believe you'll be able to go from the higher one down to the lower one. So you'll be able to load them up in the same process. And then the .NET 4 one can still use the one up the other way. I might be able to file that and whatnot. Yes? What up? Healing? Elaborate on that? Well, basically, so with Link, you have your extensions. You can put it's basically enumerables. Everybody know what Link is? Who doesn't know? Who's using Link? Those of you who didn't raise your hand, look into it. It's very cool. It makes things a lot easier working with sets. So it's basically all concentrated around IEnumerable, and it gives you extensions such as queryable, which query your sets much. Text is very much like whatnot, and so the parallel extensions give you as parallel, and so you can apply these link statements to sets in parallel, and so the TPL, the task parallel library, will actually kind of care of figure out how you want to. Say, I'm trying to think of a good example because I don't actually. Basically, if you're processing a set, you know, you're saying normally you'd say for each or select or. Yeah. And in your code, in your syntax, all you're saying is as parallel. And so if you have a set that is a very good candidate for parallel processing, you just say as parallel, and then everything else is pretty much exactly the same because it's all built on top of link and extensions. And then the task parallel library, it's all built on top of the task parallel library. That will figure out the best way to. Isn't that a good promise? Yeah, right. So moving on to code contracts. Code contracts follow kind of the concept of design by contract, wherein it's a language agnostic and declarative way to express your coding assumptions in .NET programs. So you're telling the compiler and your program exactly what you expect to happen. And this kind of shows itself in a few different ways. You can have preconditions, so things that must be true before your method runs, so you can do things, put parameters and whatnot. And then post conditions, so things after your return results and everything. And then invariants, which are very similar to debug.assert. And so now I will jump in and actually show some examples of this. All right, so this is all part of the framework. So now I'll make a message here. This is just a new application, a little Hello World application. Return an int. Say do something. Take in a couple of parameters. And now I'm going to start off by saying the expectations of what I want my method to do. So I'm sorry, I'm moving a little bit fast here. I just used ReSharper too. I use this contract static class here, has static methods on it. And that is in the system diagnostics contracts namespace. This is the new namespace for all the stuff lives. And so off of contract, we've got a whole bunch of stuff that we use. So I had listed three things. There's actually a whole bunch of things on there right now. And so in the beginning, I can say requires. So contract requires. So this is specifies, you can see in here, specifies a precondition contract for the enclosing method or property and throws an exception with the provided method if the condition for the contract fails. So I can say that I require my first parameter, my X parameter, to always be greater than 0. And this one, I'm actually just going to leave that the same. I'm not going to give a message. Also going to say that y also needs to be greater than 0. And this one I will give a message. It's a condition. I mean, this is you can see here, it's a bool condition down here. So you can do whatever statement you want. And then I'm going to do some work here. say X times Y. These are really big numbers. I could use big integer here. And then just go ahead and return the result. So now, because I'm only accepting positive numbers, and then I'm multiplying them, I can now assert that I can use the ensures assert and ensure that my result, my post condition, certain criteria, more specifically that it's positive. So the assert specifies a post condition contract or provide an exit condition. So I can say contract result of type int. So int is current type here. So this will, this is kind of a little helper method that will give me the result of my processing of my method. Just make my conditions off of that. So I can say that is also greater than zero. And then I can provide the message here or not. So that's the syntax. I can go ahead and call this message, this method. Passing the appropriate proper responses. And now, contract namespace is a part of the base class library, but there are all kinds of tooling around it that comes separate. So the tooling and the namespace and the classes are separate. So what I'm looking at here is in my properties, I have this code contracts tab, which is actually something that came up when I installed from the Microsoft code contracts team. I ran their installer, and they gave me this that helps me kind of manage the runtime checking of my contracts. So in here, I can kind of enable everything. So we can see we're in the debug. Oh, actually, we're in the release configuration here. Do all that. We're in the debug configuration where all of this stuff is turned on. And so now, if I go back to my program, I'm going to go through all these options, but as you can see, it's very, very configurable, the checks that it's doing. So now when I compile, I can go there we go. Now we can see this the code contracts plugin that I installed. Now going and checking my code statically, running through it and making sure that all my assertions are met. And so we can see that we have 9 assertions and 9 were correct and none failed. And so if I go in, all of this stuff is now static. My values that I'm passing in are static, which is not very real world, but for the sake of this example, I can show you the power of the checking. So I can go in and I can pass in a bad value, something that I've specifically said in my contract that is no good. And if I compile this again, we run the checking again, the static analysis again, and we can see that I'm going to get an error message, well, a warning. It's not going to break my compile, but it's going to warn me that we have a broken assumption here. We have failing. And so we have 2 lines here. We see the second one is location related to previous warning. And then down below, we have now 8 correct and 1 false. But we have 2 lines here. This one is referring to line 11, where we're actually passing in this bad value. And then the second one is referring to line 17, which is where we've actually made the assertion with our comment. And so now if I run this, it will actually, it'll throw up an exception. I'll throw an exception. It wasn't met. And now if I switch to release mode, this is just a matter of configuration. We can saw we can see earlier I disabled this for release mode. The runtime checking is off, so it acts much like the, I'm not actually doing anything, putting anything out, but I ran that and it didn't throw anything. So I can show you, write that result out. So now it runs and runs naturally because all that stuff is turned off. Now for this configuration, I can easily turn it back on again. So if I actually do want to turn that on. Also, you can the contract, oops. The namespace actually has a contract failed event. So you can actually write code that triggers, in addition to these exceptions, you can write code that, that triggers when these contracts. So let's go ahead and take some input from the command line. So now we're doing the static analysis, which, as I said earlier, is not really a very real-world scenario. We'll do a little more real-world scenario, as much as you can get with a hello world. And we'll actually take in a value, or read a value from console. As the caller. Well, that would be one way that you could do it. But generally, this is just to, you're not making these assertions to kind of bubble up exceptions. It's more or less to use tooling like this to kind of show you where your code is good or not. At runtime, I showed that you could turn it off and on at runtime. Generally speaking, you don't really want to do that. I mean, you don't want to release an app that's throwing these exceptions from this. I don't know. But I believe so. I believe that, yeah, that'll bubble up into through that stack. It'll throw an exception when that requires happens. And so you fill that with normal. Does that answer your question? Well, you can enable it in the debug configuration in which it will throw, or you can attach to that contract failed event and handle it. So you can actually, yeah, so if you wanted to actually capture these events in production, not throw an exception and blow up your whole app, but actually catch those events, you can attach to that contract failed event and do whatever, log it or whatever. So the user never actually sees it, but you can still benefit from those. So now what I've done is I've taken input text. So I'm taking in text from the outside world that I don't know what it is. I'm converting it to an int32. I'm not doing any checks on it. And so we can see the framework has actually, in my code, given me my little purple squigglies here. And if I hover over that, we can see code contracts requires unproven x is greater than 0. So at this point, it's saying, I don't know what you've passed in here. I can't tell you whether this will be right or not. And if we go down to our warnings, we can see 8 correct. 1 is not false. It's just unknown. Could be true. Could be false. And so to get rid of that, you can actually make your check. Say the value is less than, I guess, less than. And so now if I compile this again, now we should be all copacetic. Because now even though I'm taking in those outside values, I'm doing that proper checking. Yes. Yeah, that's actually a good point. I'm not sure how that really works. So he's saying that I'm now passing in, I'm taking this input value from the command line, and I'm passing it in as both X and Y, for on which I have the same assertion that they must both be greater than 0. Which kind of sucks. Yeah. Yes. Take in two values from the console. This. There you go. Yep. Because now we're using two different values, you can say that. So that first one, I guess X will blow up and we won't even get to Y because we're using the same. But yeah, that is very interesting to point out. So this is all very, very fun to play with, and obviously provides a lot of that. It works a lot like debug assert. Oh, I didn't show that one. You can say your invariant. So at any given time, I can say contract.invariant and then just make any assertion and throw a message, pretty much exactly like debug assert. But the difference here is, actually, before I go on, any questions on this? Any more questions? No. So, they do have some attributes. Correct. So I haven't played with the attributes very much. They do have the contract invariant method. And I'm not actually sure what it does. All of the, yeah, no, I don't really know. All of this stuff I've done with it is these specific assertions that you're making via code, via this interface. They do have some attributes, so. But you can go in and play with it. So, jumping back to the slide deck, why is this useful? So, obviously, it's useful for a whole bunch of reasons, but some of the main ones are debugging, asserting your assumptions, and saying specifically how your code works, and letting the tooling help you. So, we can see that that code that I wrote, we're accepting a value, converting it to an int. Somebody didn't put in an int on the command line, they, you know, throw an exception, so we're good there, right? But no, we don't ever want that int to be less than zero, and saying that at some point, then the tooling can actually show us that we're valid, that passing in an invalid, allowing in invalid value. Then we can write our code to make those errors and warnings. So right now I actually showed the basic kind of code contract tooling that's installed as kind of property page and part of the compile time experience. There's also a tool called text, link there. That's actually a unit test generation framework. So you can point it at, it's separate from code contracts. You can point it at any project and it'll go through your code and it'll just try to write automated tests for it, try to generate tests for it. So in the example of our code where we had those, we're taking in int parameters, it'll try passing in values for the various boundaries of that. So it'll try to pass min value, max value, zero, all that. And basically just try and break your code for you. And now PEX works with code contracts and understands code contracts. They're actually giving it more information to try and write better tests. So now it can try and write tests that break your contracts or whatever, or not try to write tests, not waste time writing tests. So any questions? Those are all hands. All right, cool.
I have a question.
Yes. What way? Tell who's, what meaning, who's telling and who's asking? Right, so you're basically saying I know what this method is expecting or expecting. Is that, that's kind of too much information. That's that method's problem. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. I guess that's kind of a rhetorical question, right? Right, and obviously this whole point is even is exaggerated even more because these will pass up all the way up the chain. If this method is calling this method, this, all the way, you know, 10 method calls down, this has a contract that requires this value up here to be greater than. Yeah, it is what it is. Yes, and so that's kind of the driving idea, but I think to his point, kind of saying that that's too much information. The caller shouldn't necessarily know what is valid data, or maybe it should. I don't know. Maybe this is in documentation somewhere. But the fact is, with contracts, you're actually making for better or worse, like bubbling these things up. These are all just, in this case, with this plugin, they're all compile warnings. It's not going to be. Okay, moving on. So, the language enhancements. We're talking about the enhancements to the existing language. So, we've got a few new C Sharp 4.0 features. We've got improved COM interop, generally speaking. Again, I'm not going to really show any of that. It's not really my forte. We also have named and optional parameters. How many of you know what this means? So, most of you. Okay, so I'm going to show an example of it later. But it's a pretty cool little feature. Covariance and contravariance. How many of you know what that means? I'll go over that in a little bit. And I'm moving over to VB10. I must admit that I am a developer. You've caught up to us. You caught up to the C-sharp guys, because now you have auto-implemented properties, collection initializers, statement lambdas. And then I'm sure you're excited about this one, implicit line. And you've also, at the same time, got covariance and contravariance. So what covariance and contravariance is, generally speaking, is that we've fixed generics. So how many of you have gone in and tried to use generics and not been able to do what fix that. So covariance means describes the substitution of related types such that the ordering for the more restrictive types is less restrictive. So we have a derived class, a class that's derived from a base class. And so down here, we're actually creating a list. We have an iEnumerable of the derived class. So that's the strongly. Down here, we have iEnumerable of base. We're assigning it to. Looks like it always should have worked, right? But it didn't. Very frustrating if you ever tried it. Contravariance is going the other way. So describe the substitution as the type starts the ordering from the more restrictive type, less restrictive type to the code class. So here, this is especially interesting in delegates. So this one is a method declaration that's expecting a delegate, an action of type derived. But down in here, this foo method is actually defined on base. That's what this uses. So that's all we need to pass in this will just. So if this actually uses something on derived that's not on base, it won't. Or it will. Any questions there? I know that's kind of confusing, but it's basically boils down to you can now do what you have done. Frustrated if you can. So now I'll just jump into a real quick demo and show these things in action. Yes. Right. Yep. We'll go back to our example here. Trying to get rid of this stuff here. So, named and optional parameters. I'm going to add a third parameter. I'm going to assign it to 0. Oops. Call it something different. So now I have x, y, z. I'm saying z equals 0. Optional parameter. I'm saying this is optional. It doesn't get passed in. We'll assign it to 0. So before, you might do this via an overload. So if you wanted to have three parameters, but you wanted the ability to only pass in two, and default to a third, you might write an overload like this that just calls in x, y, and passes in 0. But now you don't need to do that. You can just delete this overload, and it'll work. So we can see here, I can just still go ahead and run this without changing my existing code. I've added that parameter. I can go ahead and run this. It does what it does. No exception. Named parameters. So that's optional parameters. What's that? No, no. You can do whatever you want. Actually, haven't tried. Yeah, no, it is. Yeah, it's the last. So it's the last parameter. It's just that's why the overload example is a good example, because those your overloads are going to be kind of incrementally, decrementally. Yes. Yes. So now here, I've now made Y default. So now only X is required. So I can delete that. I can run that. That will work. And I want to now call it and pass in X because I have to. Don't pass in Y, but pass in Z. Give that a value. So this is the syntax here for giving a named parameter. So I'm specifying here's the parameter. Even though this is kind of the order, if I drop this out, ordering is such that this would be Y now, because that was the order of the parameters. And I'm going to say VB, yes. Thanks. Yeah, sure. You had to point that out. I was hoping to get by with that. But, oh, yes, absolutely. Yep. So now using the name parameters, I can also apply X. Oops. Y, I mean. Provide them in any order. Yeah, and so if you want to, you know, grossly misuse it, X is still required. And I'll go ahead and just add X at the end. My method is still getting passed in. It's just changing the order. You know what? I don't know. I'm assuming not. That's a great question. So I can say in A. Looks like that's compiling. Yeah, it is. So there you go. All right. So actually, I'm not going to really show any of the covariance. The example that I gave for covariance, pretty straightforward. Contravariance, often it's easier to see it in action. So here's kind of the best way to show it is with event handlers. So here's kind of a snippet from a Windows form app where we're handling the key down event. Oh, down here we have our delegate, just a regular delegate that accepts event args. And it only does do anything with them. It just handles the event, as you've probably written plenty of these. But even if it just did something with the base event args, we don't need specific arguments. So up here, we're assigning the key down and the mouse click events to our delegate down here that just does something, doesn't even care what the args are. And because we're not actually using any of the specific stuff to key down or the mouse click event, did use one to the next level and actually. It is when you're thinking about it and you're looking at this code. Well, I mean, this code is relatively straightforward. Try to kind of put it together in your head, at least for me. It's slightly difficult to grok, but basically the generics work the way you expect them to. Kind of cast your objects back and forth properly. Any questions on that? Nope. Oh, I said I would show lazy loading earlier too. So lazy loading is very interesting. Get that method at this point. So, lazy loading, you can see it's part of the framework, part of the base library, I believe it's in system. It's actually at the core. Let's see. Yes, system.lazy. I can say a lazy variable of type string. Do lazy. I'm assigning it to a new lazy. I'm not actually assigning it to any particular value. And then we can see on the next line, what we have are properties here. So much like nullables,
how many of you are using nullables?
Nullables
put onto value types and actually allow pass in null. So nullables will have the value property, and it also has value. Is it null or not? This one similarly has the value. It also has is value created. So at this point, when we've nuded up, as I've done here, this value is going to be null. It's not actually going to get evaluated and loaded until we try to access it. So until we try to access it, value created will be false. I can show that. That should return false, and now I'm actually going to access it. Hold on, if that's confused. Some of you are confused already as to what is going to happen here. That's fine. And then I'm going to show it again. So we will write to the console line. At this point, it'll be false, and then we'll access it. It will get loaded, however we say it should get loaded. And then after it's loaded, it should be true. Now, if I run this, if I hit F5 and run this, throws an exception. The lazily initialized type does not have a public parameterless constructor. So string type is a value type, and it does not have a constructor. So it says, I don't know, you know, you've asked me to create a new instance of this. I don't really know what you want, so I'm just going to bail out. So we can go up to our constructor here for our lazy, and this constructor down here, a whole lot of pop-ups coming up. Here's a list of what we can pass in. So you can see we can actually pass in a value factory. It's a method. It's a lambda that returns our type T, in this case a string. And so we actually provide a lambda expression that or a delegate that tells lazy loader how to actually get that data. And so this is code. It can be anything. So right now I'm supplying a specific value. I'm just returning a static value. But this can call a method. It can call a web service or, you know, whatever. So now if I run this, my example should work. So now we see false. Has it been loaded? False. Access that value. That's my value. That's the thing I just typed in. Now, is it loaded? Yes. We've accessed it, so now it's loaded. So now, we saw earlier that it expected something that had a default parameterless constructor, such as a class. If I go ahead and make a new class, just call it my class, give it a default parameterless constructor. Okay. Class, I'm going to assign that to a property. Resharper is the greatest thing ever, by the way. Visual Studio 2010, which is what I'm doing all this coding in, was hailed as Visual Studio 2008 with Resharper, even by some Microsoft folks. I did not find that to be completely true. It was certainly better than 2008. So I have Resharper installed on here. It seems to be working just fine. So now, I'm going to have change this initialization to my class. Remove this because I want to just use my default constructor. Obviously, I still can pass in an expression that will get me a new class. I can pass in a factory. But for now, I won't. So this is strongly typed. So before I had my var.value was the string. Now it is strongly typed because this is generic as my class, so I can access it. So I can actually access that name. And if I run this, it should run exactly as I expected. Now it is same deal. Is it created? False. Go ahead and access it. Print that name. So now we've accessed it. Now it's loaded. That's pretty straightforward. It's pretty powerful. So this example, you know, it's only a couple of lines, and it might seem pretty simple what I'm doing. But when you really start to get into this, you can have classes that are lazy, that have lazy loaded properties that might go and hit a database or something and load it. So if you don't ever access that variable, that value, that database call won't ever happen. Any questions on that? or you can pass in a factory. So, yes, Alanda, or I think just the delegate. So if I have like a public static, my class, so I have kind of a factory method that I can create here. Pretty sure I can just pass this in. Oops. Say whenever you want to load this, go ahead and call this factory. So if I run this, now it's calling my factory method, my static method. What's that? Well, it is regular code. So yeah, I mean, if I was accessing the database and something went wrong or whatever, then that will throw an application exception when this happens. So we can see that on my command line, I've hit that first line and now I go to access it. And only when I go to access it, it executes that code and then triggers my exception. Does that answer your question? Well, so it expects either a default parameterless constructor or this a factory method, a factory delegate to actually return it, which doesn't take any parameters or anything. Does that answer your question? Or? It's just newing up a new instance using the default. That's what it tries to do if you don't give it any other. So moving on. Well, again, you can wire it up to any code that you want, any delegate method that returns type T and the parameters you can call with whatever you want. So if you have a lazy loader thing that calls a WCF service to get your value or whatever, you provide a proxy method that, or you know, a static method, a factory method that will go new up your WCF service, make the call, bring it back, and return that. So yeah, it's intentionally generalized so that you can just whatever you want. If you saw, you actually had options. Lazy thread safety mode. So you can do, here are the couple modes that you can do. So non-publication only, execute publication. I don't even really know what they mean. And we've also got a bool overload. So you just pass in a bool is thread safe. So I can only assume, I don't know, but I can only assume that they're using TPO underneath. So going back to the slides, if we look in kind of the ecosystem today, but Microsoft ecosystem today, these things are pretty general programming ecosystem, round and big for a long time. But in the .NET world, we're seeing emerging language trends around. So basically, we've got our declarative programming instead of the, as opposed to imperative, specifying exactly what you want to do and how you declare what you want to do. So XAML, where you're declaring your interface, as in WinForms, as opposed to WinForms, where you're imperatively kind of setting properties, you know, with equals, blah. Instead, you're just kind of declaring that via XML, and the framework goes and translates that. We also have dynamic things like scripting languages, Ruby, Python, basically it all comes down to the concept of late. Sharp is a statically typed language, a declarative language, and so you need a strong type in order to, so you need to say, my variable is int bar, int x equals blah, blah, blah. I have to say that it's a type of int in order to work with it. I can't say, I don't really know where to do it. Opposed to with the dynamic languages, you just kind of say, here's my variable, it is what it is, go ahead and use it. And so they use the concept of duck typing. If it talks like a duck, quacks like a duck, looks like a duck, at least for my point. So if I have an object, if I need to quack something, if I need to call a quack method, and I have an object that has a quack method, I don't really care what it is. I don't care if it's a dog that's quacking or a duck that's quacking. I just want to quack. So I'd be able to do that in C# without actually having a defined inheritance chain, iQuackable or whatever. Dynamic languages get rid of all. And finally, we have concurrent. So concurrency, parallelism, threading, these are all very important trends. So to deal with the issues of concurrency, we actually introduced a new rule. We talked earlier about the TPL, the task parallelizable API for dealing with, but we actually have a language. Apparently thread safe, so it's a functional programming language derived from OCaml and ML. It's very good for computational intensive problems, highly parallel problems, and language. Because it is a functional language, it's also first class with full Visual Studio. But a functional language, one of the more popular functional languages is have a defined set of stuff. Also, Link is functional in nature. Have a defined set of things that you're defining a certain function. And in F#, functions can be passed around as parameters. But the important thing in terms of concurrency with F# is that all the variables are immutable. That just eliminates the certainly helps you out. Fortunately, that's all I can say about F# because I don't actually know it. I can't give you any examples. That is, if that sounds like something you're interested in, I would definitely advise that you look into it a little. So jumping back to the new C#4.0 features, the dynamic space, we actually have late binding support via the dynamic keyword. I have this listed under the sharp features slide, just tie it back there, but I'm didn't actually check because I'm not a VB programmer. So I'm actually going to show this dynamic keyword in usage a little bit later. First, I'm going to kind of talk about the dynamic language. Why do we need a dynamic language run? Well, we see here, we have these dynamic, some things, some applications, some concepts are just better expressed, or at least more easily, more efficiently expressed with the dynamism that I explained earlier on, where we're talking about duck typing, and we just go through all the pomp and circumstance of declaring an I quackable and having it, we just want to quack something. And so our code might be better expressed in that situation. But we also want to write a sharp. We need them to interact. This is not only case for dynamic time. So I can actually, in my statically typed application, call via the dynamic language runtime. Or I can just run it via the dynamic. And as this graph shows, it's all on top of the comments. Common interface. Go the other way around. That's actually kind of what I'm going to be talking about here. So at the core, we have our dynamic language runtime, which at the very least includes things like
expression trees, dynamic dispatch, which is kind of the dispatching between the call site caching, which is really what methods. On top of that, we have the different languages that interact with the dynamic language, dynamic languages, and the static type languages, or whatever. And then below, we have our different binders. So this is how they interact. So we can actually pass in via the dynamic language runtime, we can pass in a C# or .NET CLR object. Dynamic language runtime will convert that or bind that into, say, a Python object. Or binders are very powerful because they know how to translate Python object is sufficiently different than JavaScript object, which is part of the hash type of stuff. JavaScript binder, which knows. And then finally, we have the COM binder. So this is one of the ways that COM is now easy. I don't have to worry about all those unknown interfaces and whatnot. As I said earlier, I'm not a COM developer, so I don't really know what I'm talking about. But unknown is the bane of a lot of people's existence. You don't have to go through all that pomp and circumstance. Dynamic COM binder. We'll see. Yeah. Any questions on that? That's a good question. So it all depends on the implementation of the binding. Obviously, you know, if you write a poor implementation of binding or runtime, so each of these runtimes I know I'm kind of dodging your question. I can't really give you any real statistics, but that's kind of the point, is that obviously you're going to have a little bit of overhead from the DLR itself, and then specific implementations. Or Ruby implementation, 20 times longer than the Python. Now, we can actually jump some demos. There's a visualization of the duck typing. So I've got a dog that looks like a duck and quacks like a duck. That's all I care about. All right. So, how are we doing on time there, Mark? Got 30 minutes? 9:45? Oh, okay, cool. Yep. All right, so first thing I'm going to do is actually load in. So I'm saying that the DLR is all part of the framework, and now I'm going and I'm adding assemblies that are not part of the framework, which might be kind of off-putting. But these are actually built. So I'm adding in the IronPython DLL. I'm going to be showing an IronPython example. The Microsoft Dynamic library and the scripting library. So these are actually all built on top of the stuff that is in the core. So the DLR lives in the core, and this is kind of library built on top of that. So the IronPython is one of those implementations. So I'm going to add a reference to that. So the DLR comes with everything. This I installed separately. You can just, I mean, once you've installed it, I'm literally just bringing in these assemblies into my project. So they're just assemblies. You don't need to install it necessarily. I did happen to, but. Doesn't exist. Now that I have that, I go and I get my runtime. Create a runtime, so this is the runtime that everything runs in. And then I'm going to go and I'm going to add new item. I'm going to add a text file because the designer does not actually support editing Python files at this point. I'm going to say demo.py, P-Y, kind of just arbitrary. And then now I'm in my demo pile. I'm going to write a little bit of Python code. I'm going to write a hello world function. I'm going to print.
simple enough. See, this dynamic languages gets rid of all the pomp and circumstance. This is all we need to do. And so now, I'm going to use using the dynamic keyword to say late binding. I'm going to use my runtime. I'm going to say use file demo.py. So what this is going to do is the runtime is going to go grab this file, go in and interpret everything in it. And so if I just had something, which is, this is completely legitimate in Python, if I just had something outside, so this is a method definition, a method that you can call, and then this is just some line of code. The first one is a line of code that just runs. So when this script gets executed, this would run, and then every time I called my method. Cannot debug, as far as I know, as far as I've tried, you cannot debug quite yet, which is kind of, the error messages for Python code, not that fun. But so we can see here, I'm not really getting any IntelliSense at this point because I'm using. So when I hover over demo, my demo attribute here, I don't even my variable here, it says it's a dynamic type. It doesn't really know anything about it, which it can be anything. It's late bound. But the way that you interact with this is you can actually go just call this method directly. So now if I run this, assuming I've done everything correctly, I should now go and print hello. That's coming right from the Python script. Yes? That happens when this method is running is when it happens. So I can actually go At right when this method is called, right here, that's when it's actually brought in. So I might run out of time, but I have an example coming up where I can actually go through a loop, edit the file while my app is running, hit this method again, it'll reload it again. Yep. So interesting little fact here. Now, speaking of IntelliSense, now that I've actually used it, I can go and have it helps out a little bit. I mean, I can go and say, you know, call a completely irrelevant thing and then go and try and use that again, and there it is. But hey, they're assuming that you know what you're doing. So now let's I'm gonna go ahead and pass something in. So I've got pass my name, and so I can kind of show this binding back and forth between Python and the .NET stuff. So I'm gonna call this a var just to prove that dynamic is not var. Save results. Now, instead of Python printing it out for me, I'm just going to print it myself. Now, I haven't changed here, but I've got to change this. And so now, instead of printing, I'm going to just return that. I run this. Show it in action first, and then I'll set a debug point. We can look at what happens. So you see I printed out my result. So let me run that again. Set a breakpoint here. We can kind of drill into what exactly is going on. Here's my IntelliTrace over here, so we can kind of see what we've done. So this is all Visual Studio stuff. So we've hit my breakpoint. And if we do a quick watch on demo, see the value type. See the type is object. I've actually seen the type as dynamic before. I'm not exactly sure how it determines whether it's dynamic or object, but the current implementation is bounds. As of the point of right now in our breakpoint, that is the current implementation. Then we can actually see the value as well. And so now I have my result, which I can kind of. So to answer your earlier question, we don't have really debugging in line with the Python stuff, but you know, we still have all the regular debugging here in Visual Studio with C#. So we can see this is a type of string. And because this is a var, a result is var, if I try to change this to an int, it works. Oh, that's because demo is returning the dynamic. Okay, I'm sorry. Not a very good example. Add a true bar. So bar some value equals 1, 3. So that's going to be an int. Run that again. Hit my breakpoint. So now if I go and add a quick watch to this bar, where's my quick watch? You can see var is, it's not a type of object, and the late bound type is int. It is an int. A var is an int. It's just shorthand. And so if I try to change this to a string value, it's going to throw an exception because I can't assign that. Whereas if I go to my result, as I showed before, my dynamic result, and I add my quick watch, I can go and I can change it to whatever I want. And not only can I do that, so right now it's a string, change it to an int, and it changes to an int. Current type right now is an int. Things like, say that again? Yeah, so evaluate a Python script or a string. Yep, absolutely. So they have, this is the runtime. They also have an engine, so you can use that engine to evaluate, say, python.createEngine. Oops. Well, so you can, and then you'll create a scope. So here we have a couple of different things. I've only played around with this a little bit, but we have, like, you can execute an expression. You can create a scope, that's, which then you can kind of pull in. So, yes, you can do all of this on the fly. What's that? Well, I guess, I mean, anytime you're using dynamic, you can't control what the result type is going to be at any given time anyway. So you can try. So any questions on that? I guess that's where we're going to end up. Unfortunately, we didn't get to the MEF stuff. If you want to stick around, I can actually show you what I was talking about earlier, my example of kind of editing the file and updating it. So we actually have, for dynamic languages, the very next session in this room, extending .NET applications with the dynamic language runtime. So this kind of goes in depth into talking about. And then we missed out on the MEF stuff. Let me see if there's anything else. Oh, nope, that's it. So, thanks for coming.
I have to wrap.
Yes.